Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Rhonda, and I'm a compulsive eater, and I'll be your chairperson today. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation, followed by the Serenity Prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. We start this meeting by remembering our common purpose to extend the heart and hand of the OA Fellowship to those who still suffer. Let us be mindful of OA's unity with diversity policy, which respects our differences, yet unites us in the solution to our common problem. Whatever problem you may have with food, you are welcome at this meeting. Today, we are delighted to have Laurie C. joining us to share his experience, strength, and hope on the topic of Into Action. Welcome, Laurie. It's good to see you again.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to share. The chapter Into Action from the Big Book is one of my favorite chapters. I guess a lot of chapters are my favorite. But this is one of my favorites because it is a clear indication that we're to work the steps really fast, that we're to get to recovery as soon as we can. It contains some promises, and that's very important. But the path that is set out by the Big Book is speedy. Five chapters spent on the problem and the solution, steps one and step two. One chapter on step three and step four. And now we have one chapter on steps 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And we'll see that unlike the steps, which are written as we read them at every meeting, different steps require different times to do. And we don't have to do the, we don't have to take the same time for each step. This is often a mistake that's made, at least from the Big Book perspective, because we have our 12 and 12s, the AA 12 and 12, the OA 12 and 12s, and most fellowships have 12 and 12s, which provide approximately the same amount of space for each step. But you'll see that the Big Book does not do that. And this is in accordance with the history of the steps. In the original history of AA, you'll see Bill will talk about, and you'll find this also on page 262 of the fourth edition of the Big Book, that there are originally approximately six steps. Step one, step four, five, nine, 11, and 12. And those are the steps that get all the major space. Step two gets a bit more space in the Big Book, but step six and seven get a paragraph each. Does it take 10 days, 20 days to do step six? You'll find out not. So I'm going to concentrate on the chapter Into Action, steps 5 through 11. But I want to start off with step four, because an understanding of the Big Book's approach to step four may help a bit in understanding what step five is all about from the Big Book perspective. Step four, from the Big Book perspective, as I have been taught, isolates four character defects that we have, not 20, not seven, not 25, not 100, but only four. And they're huge. One is what the Big Book calls selfish, but is clearly what the Big Book means by selfish is not what the dictionary says, wanting things for my own good. It is wanting things to happen the way I want them to. It is self-will. It is wanting to be in charge of the show, to be in charge of the past. When the past doesn't go our way, we feel resentments. To be in charge of the future, when the future isn't going to go our way, we feel fear. We just want to be in charge. And so self-will is one of our major defects. The second defect is dishonesty. And from the big book perspective, from the perspective of the people who wrote this book, their dishonesty was lying, cheating, and stealing. I mean, that's what it is. That's what they did. They were active alcoholics who did terrible things to their families and to their coworkers, and for which they repented. Many of us in OA, I wouldn't classify myself as one of them, have suffered terribly in our childhoods and in our personal lives, even our present lives. Terribly, traumatic experiences for which we were not responsible. And our sense of dishonesty is not that we lied or cheated or stole, but in terms of some of the traumas that we experience, our dishonesty may be not telling the truth to when the truth should be told, or not telling the truth to ourselves about the reality of a situation. And these are very significant forms of dishonesty, people living in a life of woulda, coulda, shoulda. If only this had not happened, I would be a different person. And it happened 20 years ago. It did happen. You can't change the past. What are you going to do about the present? Is a major aspect of dishonesty. Or not speaking up. We're full. Most of us, I don't know if most of us, I am a people pleaser. I have been a people pleaser all my life. And many of us are people pleasers. And our dishonesty is often that we don't speak up when we should be speaking up for things that are right or that we believe in, because we're afraid of what people will think of us. So dishonesty from a big book perspective has to be enlarged, I think, for many of us in no way. And then self-seeking is the third character defect. And self-seeking is really, in a sense, having other people define us, who we are, rather than being defined by our relationship with what we deeply believe in, our higher power, whatever that means to each of us. And, you know, because if we're defined by what we deeply believe in, we feel good about ourselves. If we are living according to what we believe in, which is what we're going to end up with by the end of step 9, then we feel as if we're living the right life. And our problem as addicts, when we're living in our addiction, is that we're not living according to what we deeply believe in. And in many ways, we're living 180 degrees from what we believe in the wrong direction. And then there is, so self-seeking is all about having people, other people define us. And then the fourth character defect is fear. It just paralyzes. The future won't go my way because the past hasn't gone my way. And the big book then, by dealing with those in the resentment section of the big book, of the step 4, then goes to fears right off the bat and says, okay, you have these fears. What do you think, what kind of a person do you think you should be in relation to those fears if you're living according to what you deeply believe in, what your God tells you or what your higher power guides you into being? What kind of a person would you be? And I often liken this to instead of being the child hiding under the bed covers because of what might be underneath the bed, you are the adult shining a light. And sometimes it discloses some dangerous things, but sometimes it discloses nothing. And so when you picture yourself, what kind of a person would I be if I were living according to what I deeply believed in and according to reality? You get a picture of living without fear. You have a strategy for life. You're an adult. You've grown up. And the big book says we commence to outgrow fear. And then the big book focuses in the third section of step 4 on relationships, complex, difficult relationships, where it asks us where we have been self-willed, dishonest, and inconsiderate, which means using other people to define who we are. And so those are the three other character defects. And it basically says, where do we go wrong and what should we have done instead? And again, we're imagining ourselves to be people who are not self-willed, who are honest and loving, and who don't look to other people to define us. What would we have done in the relationships that we either have or have had, where we would have, what would we have done differently? So before we even get to step 5, we've identified 4 character defects, and they're major ones. They encompass all the others. You know, if you, people talk about, oh, gossip's a character defect. Well, Gossip is an action I take because of self-will. I want other people to like me and not to like the other person I'm gossiping about. Dishonesty, I'm not telling the full truth about the person I'm gossiping about. Self-seeking, I want them to like me rather than the other person. And fear, they'll find out, you know, or that I'll be found out. So, I mean, all these four character defects are now examined in step four, before we even get to step five, in a way that gives us a beginning of a picture of the kind of persons we can be if we lived according to what we believed in, rather than what other people want us to be, or what we think other people want us to be, or what we think we are because of what other people have done to us. It's just a very different perspective. And that brings us to step five. Now, the chapter into action starts with step five, and it was written at a time when when AA was only available in Akron, Ohio, in Cleveland, Ohio, and New York. And so it was written for as a do-it-yourself manual for people who were reading this book and trying to get the directions for doing the steps. So the first few pages of Into Action are all about, well, why do we do it? And then how do we find someone with whom we can do step five? So the first page of Into Action, page 72, want to point out, even though the step as it's written on the wall says admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs, you'll see right in the middle of page 72, this requires action on our part, which when completed will mean that we admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our defects, not our wrongs. And the importance of this is you'll find that the step seven prayer, even though as it's written on the wall, as we read at meetings, says our shortcomings, humbly ask God to remove our shortcomings, the prayer that we say asks God to remove our defects of character. And so there's no sort of major thinking that has to be done. Well, what's the difference between a wrong and a shortcoming and a defect? It all means the same. So we admit the exact nature of our defects. Why do we do it? They give us one reason. If we don't do it, we'll go back to drinking. We'll go back to our addiction. That's our experience. I'll give you three other reasons. Confession is good for the soul. We discover that we're no different from anyone else. That's the thing that is absolutely amazing. I don't know how many step fives I've done with how many people, either listening or giving them away, and how, in a sense, how boring it is, because people will say, or I will say, I've been there, I've done that, I've had those thoughts, I've done those things, I almost did those things, I could have done those things. We're all the same. That's one way I guarantee confidentiality when I hear step fives is I forget them because they're all the same. And the third one, and I think it's a very good and important reason, is if we do step five with someone who has been where we have been, or for the Australians and Brits and some Canadians among us have been where we have been, we are able to get feedback from other people to help us understand where our defects of character have shown up, whether we're being too hard on ourselves or too soft on ourselves. Not in a directorial way. You know, I learned this first time I listened to a step five, I was very judgmental, and the person I was doing it with had a lot of experience in AA before he joined OA. And he said to me, listen, this is my step five. It's not yours. And I don't care whether you think that what I did wasn't that bad. For me, it was bad. And you have no right to tell me that it wasn't bad. And I immediately understood that he was right. And so when I listen to a step five, I don't say, you know, oh, you're this or you're that or this is wrong. I say, well, what about this? Or does this ring a bell with you? Does this make sense to you? And sometimes getting this feedback just opens eyes. It's just amazing. Well, do you think that maybe this might be the case? Or I've once felt that. It's a wonderful sharing experience, but it's also a way of opening people's eyes in many, many ways. So those are the reasons. Now, page 73, is all about how to find the person. And page 74. On page 96 of the big book, they point out that now that we've recovered, we can hear step fives. Let him know that you're available if he wishes to make his decision, which is step three, or to tell his story, which is step five. On page 74, they do say the rule is we must be hard on ourselves, but always considerate of others. And many of us interpret that as a way of emphasizing that from the big book perspective, we do not make amends to ourselves. That the first person we have to make amends to is not to ourselves. It is in making amends to others that we make amends to ourselves. We become different people. We become the kinds of people we need to be, people living according to what we most deeply believe in. And in doing so, we make the greatest amend to ourselves that we can. The other significant thing about step five, which is that we have to understand that we're talking about our defects of character and not all of the secrets that we have. From the big book perspective, I think that's pretty clear, that we tell our story, but we tell our story from the position of what are the defects of character that have been disclosed. On the bottom page 74, they have three necessary conditions for the person with whom we do step five. It's important that one, he be able to keep a confidence. Two, that he fully understand and approve what we're driving at. And three, that he will not try to change our plan. You do it with someone from OA or someone from AA or someone in any 12-step fellowship, you're guaranteed to have those three. Then at page 75, there's a little bit of a ritual there that I like to go through. We explain to our partner what we're about to do and why we have to do it. He should realize that we are engaged upon a life and death errand. And when I hear people's step fives that they're doing for the first time, I like to do that. I like to ask them, explain why this is important, because this is a very solemn moment in the lives of all of us, of both of us, I should say. We're talking on an intimate level that most people normally don't talk. It doesn't necessarily disclose an intimacy, physical intimacy. It's not physical intimacy, but it's not even confession. It is, however, an examination of the innermost parts of our soul, and it's very important. Unfortunately, on page 75, the big book's directions are entirely vague. We pocket our pride and go to it, illuminating every twist of character, every dark cranny of the past. That's it. What do we do? And I can only tell you what I have found from my perspective is the most helpful. Because there's no instructions. We know that Dr. Bob did it by actually saying to people, well, you're doing this, you did that, and you're that kind of person, and you did this, and you lied, and you cheated, you stole, you did this. Right? Right, Dr. Bob. Tell me a bit about it. Well, I did this and that. Terrible, you know. And then he would say, you want God to remove your defects of character? Yes, Dr. Bob. All right, get down on your knees and ask him. You know, I mean, it was that kind of like very direct stuff. That's not quite how I've been taught. And I suggest that if you do the step four, the big book way, that you would list a resentment that you have, and then you would isolate the defect of characters and discuss the defects of characters that arose from the resentment, not talk about why the resentment is there. And I think what's important, why I believe that, is that because so many people in OA have been traumatized in the past, it is very important that they not re-traumatize themselves when doing step five. What is important is that they explain what their defects of character are in relation to the trauma. And those defects of character are usually simply they wish the past hadn't happened. In other words, they're self-willed in that they want to change what has already occurred. They want to play God. They want to say, poof, it no longer exists, which of course is impossible. And dishonesty is often as simple as it happened. It can't be changed. And self-seeking is sometimes as simple as, but I mean, as not just simple, but as powerful as, don't let this define you as a person. you're allowing another person's evil to define who you are. And you had no responsibility. And you should not do that. You should be defining yourself by your direct relationship with God, your higher power, your values. And the fears will be dealt with in the fear, but you would list the fears. So what I suggest is that they go through their, what name the resentment and name their defects of character. And I also suggest that after 5, 10 resentments, 20 resentments, if they begin to see patterns, identify them and get on with it. If they say, you know, here's, they have 6 siblings and they go through one sibling in detail, and then they say, well, the next 5 siblings, oh, they're all the same as the first one. Well, why do you have to repeat it? Same defects of character arise. There are very few patterns. There are specific patterns, but there are 5 or 6 patterns of how self-will shows up, how dishonesty shows up, how self-seeking shows up, and how fear shows up. And once you identify them and you see them recurring in the various resentments that you've written down, I have never found it, and the people I've done it with have never found it necessary to mention every single one of them, because we're really trying to identify the defects of character, not just go through a list of resentments. So then we go through fears, and it doesn't take long. I mean, once you've done 10, 15, 20 resentments, the others, you can say, well, I now see they're all these are the same as this one, or this one is the same as this one, you know, things of that sort. So you're then into fear. And then the person hearing your step 5 might be able to assist you in figuring out what kind of a person you can be in relation to this fear. And it really has to resonate with you and not with the other person. You may have a fear of heights. You're the kind of person you should be in relation to fear of heights. Might be a person who seeks therapy for it, or might be a person who avoids heights unless it's absolutely necessary to encounter them. I don't know what the answer is, and only you will know what resonates with you. But at any rate, these fears are dealt with. And work together with the person to figure out the best kind of person you can be in relation to those fears. And then in relationships, what should you have done instead? Where did you go wrong, and what should you have done instead in relation to the other 3 defects of character that were identified, the self-will, the dishonesty, and the self-seeking / inconsiderateness? What I have found, generally speaking, is the answer has generally been either get out of the relationship, not getting into the relationship, or once getting into the relationship, getting out of it sooner than you did, or investing more into the relationship than you are and thinking more of the other person than of yourself. Generally speaking, that's the reality that I've encountered from most people. Or not letting a relationship define who you are. That's step 5. And I have found that step 5 with another person, that part of step 5 that deals with another person, sharing with another person, doesn't have to take more than 2.5 hours. Now, I learned a very important lesson when I first did it this way, which was 7 years after I joined OA, going in and out of relapse. That was over 30 years ago. I've been recovered for over 30 years, but I had 7 years of relapse. My important lesson is found on page 75, after the one sentence of instructions, after pocket our pride and go to it. It says, once we have taken a step withholding nothing, we are delighted, a promise. We can look the world in the eye, a promise. We can be alone at perfect peace and ease, a promise. Our fears fall from us, a promise. The rest of that paragraphs are possibilities. We begin to feel the nearness of our Creator. We may have had certain spiritual beliefs, but we now begin to have a spiritual experience. The feeling that the drink problem has disappeared will often, but obviously not always, come strongly. We feel we're on the broad highway walking hand in hand with the Spirit of the universe. So there are 4 specific promises. And I was asked this after I did this part of step 5, after I shared, I was asked, well, are you delighted? Can you look the world in the eye? Can you be alone at perfect peace and ease? Can your fears fall from you? And I remember saying, I feel as if I've given the best step five I've ever done, but I don't know if I feel these promises. I'll tell you tomorrow morning. And I phoned him the next morning and I said, no, I don't feel quite that good. He said, you left something out. I didn't leave anything out. You left something out. And I went back and I looked at the resentments and I had a few more resentments and I had a few more fears. And I shared those. Didn't take that long. I didn't have to repeat myself. I just had a few more to deal with. Said, okay, are you delighted? Can you look the world in the eye? Can you be alone in perfect peace and ease, etc.? I don't know, I said, you know. And next day I said, no. He said, you left something out. Well, I did this three times. I went back and redid it. I think the fourth time, one of my resentments was, I've been doing this, you know, I wanted to finish step four. Why am I not finishing step four? That was one of my resentments. Anyway, by the end of that, maybe I was just worn down, but I did feel delighted. I could look the world in the eye. I could be alone at perfect peace and ease, and my fears had fallen from me. And then the person I was doing step five with, who was a big book student, said, okay, don't forget the bottom of page 75. Returning home, we find a place where we can be quiet for an hour, carefully reviewing what we have done. See, we've admitted to ourselves, we've admitted to another human being. It's time now to admit to our higher power. We thank God from the bottom of our heart that we know him better, a prayer. Taking this book down from our shelf, we turn to the page which contains the 12 steps. We read the first five steps and we ask, have we omitted anything? So we review all that we have done and then we ask if we've omitted anything. And that's the end of step five. We've now admitted to ourselves, to another human being, and to our higher power. And then on page 76, we get step six. If we can answer to our satisfaction, we then look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. Are we now ready to let God remove from us all the things which we have admitted are objectionable? Can he now take them all, every one? I guarantee you that if you do it the big book way with only four character defects and reviewed in the way I've talked about, you'll be ready to have those taken away. You're not going to say, gee, I think I'll hang on to self-will. You know, I think I'll hang on to the traumas I've experienced. I think I'll hang on to self-seeking and be a people pleaser all my life. You know, you won't do that. You say, boy, I'd love to live a life free from self-will, dishonesty, self-seeking, and fear. I mean, why wouldn't you? Because you've already seen the light at the end of the tunnel by, in step four, imagining what your higher power would want you to be in relation to your fear and what kind of a person, what you should have done. Instead of harming other people by your self-will, dishonesty, and self-seeking. The experience of those of us who are big, and this was not in the original six steps. So the answer is, yeah. You know, it's not as if we have to say, am I really, 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 really ready? Because if we do that, and we wait for this sudden lightning bolt to come, we will almost certainly go back to our addiction. Our mind is going to find reasons to give us to go back to what we're addicted to for what we have to abstain from. Just get on with it. And don't. And that's the advice that those of us who have studied the book and studied the history of the steps have for those of you who have not. Just get on with it. Don't wait until a thunderbolt has hit you. And then what is step seven in the big book? It's the prayer. That's all it is. When ready, we say something like this, and there's a prayer out for you. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. And that's step seven. That's a humble asking of God to remove your defects of character. And there is no promise whatsoever in the big book as to what happens at that point. Quite the contrary. The big book says at the middle of page 76, now we need more action without which we find that faith without works is dead. In other words, all the asking is of no value if we don't take the action necessary to get rid of our defects of character. And that is steps 8 and 9. And I've seen too many people wait for the thunderbolt to hit them at step 6, but also wait for the thunderbolt to hit them at step 7. I can't make amends until I am freed from my defects of character. Quite the contrary. It is in making amends that you are in effect saying, I want to make myself into a different person. And the only way I can do that is by cleaning up my past and my present in many cases in order to become this different person. Until I clean up my past and have a better relationship with the present and get rid of the fears that I have of the future, I can't become the kind of person I need to be. So delaying at step 7 is another recipe for disaster, another way by which your mind will find a way to persuade you to go back to that which you should be abstaining from. I have about 20 minutes left, so I'm going to barrel right on. Steps 8 and 9 were originally just step 9. We made amends for the harm that we have done. And it's all very interesting. The whole section of pages 76 to 83 details the kinds of amends that can be made. Direct amends. Do we harm others if we make them? But they were written by people who had done bad things to others. They were victimizers. And many of us in OA, and again, I don't want to count myself as one of them. I am humbled by the by the sadnesses that have occurred to other people and how they have used the steps to come out from under the traumas that they've experienced. But so many of us have been victims rather than victimizers. And the question of the harm that we have done becomes a major analysis that we have to do. Did we do any harm to the person who abused us as children? First of all, how do children do any harm anyway, right? Children aren't responsible for what adults do to them. What kind of harm have we done? Well, maybe the harm that we have done is to the people we love by not telling them of what occurred to us, or by not giving them the love that they deserve by being afraid of intimacy. Or maybe it's people who have wanted to become closer to us whom we have rejected because of the fears that we've had. Perhaps the harm that we've done is visited abuse on others, because that is hurt people hurt people. Perhaps the harms have been, in some cases, I've had some friends who've come to the conclusion that the harm they've done to the person who abused them was by not reporting them to the authorities, not pursuing them for criminal activity, living in fear and self-degradation. Sometimes the harm is simply allowing the harm to continue to harm you, rather than, because if people harm others by harming themselves, if people harm themselves by harming others, if they, in effect are harming who they are as human beings by doing harm and evil things to others, then the more harm they do, the more they harm themselves. So some people come to the conclusion that the harm they've done is not standing up for what they should be. But you cannot make amends without knowing what harm you've done. And for many of us in OA, it requires very careful analysis and is not as simple as is set out in the big book. That's why it's so important to emphasize to newcomers, you're almost certainly not going to end up apologizing to your, abusive spouse or something like that. You're probably not. Yeah, you might be doing different. Sometimes, here's the analogy. To save a child who's about to run off a cliff by grabbing their arm and breaking their arm is to do greater good than harm. You may have harmed them by breaking their arm, but at least you're holding on to them and preventing them from dying. And that may be sometimes you have to stop harm from being done by doing harm to someone, but you know, it's more harm to let that harm be done to others than it is to do some harm, be pointing people for crimes, for instance. It's very complex at times. And I urge anyone who's in that situation, first of all, not to despair at step five and saying, am I going to have to apologize to that so-and-so? And second of all, to think carefully what harm they've done, because you cannot make an appropriate amends without knowing what harm you've done. And sometimes you've done no harm whatsoever to anyone else. They have done harm to you and you owe them nothing. And there is also no right answer to that question. What you may, the conclusion you may come to today may be very different from the conclusion you come to in 5 years' time. That's fine, because it has to resonate in your heart. The amends you make, I believe, and I think the Big Book is clear about that, have to come from your heart. I have done you harm. I am so sorry for what I have done. How can I make it up? And then the other analysis is, what harm would happen to others if I made these amends? Would I do more harm than good? And that requires an analysis as well. I can't go into any details about that. If there are specific questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but I will be running out of time. I do want to discuss steps 10 and 11. But before I go on, I just want to point out one of the major amends that we make is discussed by the Big Book as living amends. And that is the amends that we make to others by simply living the right life. Sometimes that amends means that we are direct, lovingly direct and honest with other people. This relationship isn't working. Or I am sorry for what I have done. I want to invest more into the relationship. It is living the good life. It is living the right kind of life. Because if you do that, that's much more important than saying, I'm sorry. You know, we have a friend who has been an addict for many, many years. And the only amends he can ever make to us is be sober for a year. You know, if he can't apologize, we love him. We want him to be sober. And those are the amends he can make, you know, apologizing to us and then, you know, breaking their abstinence out, you know, 2 months later is not an amends. And so that living amends is something that stands, that allows us to say, I am doing this for other people. I am doing this and living a different life and a better life in order to make up to what I have done to other people. I think living amends for OA is extremely important, and we don't discuss it a lot. Now, you'll be reading the promises at the end of this meeting, found on pages 83 to 84. I just want to point out other promises and what I think are promises that we don't use in OA often enough, especially in our step 12 work. And those are the promises found on the bottom pages 84 to 85. They're often called the step 10 promises. Sometimes they're called the hidden promises. They are the promises of a life lived in recovery. And I want to emphasize them simply because in OA, we too often find people coming into meetings and people saying, oh, it's not about the food. It's about spirituality. It's about finding God. You know, I'm working on the food, but at least I'm emotionally and spiritually fit. Well, I didn't join OA to find God, and I didn't find OA to find mental stability or emotional stability. I came to OA, and I think the vast majority of us have come to OA for the promises on pages 84 to 85. We have ceased fighting anything or anyone, even alcohol, even our binge behaviors or our binge foods. For by this time, sanity will have returned. We will seldom be interested in liquor in our binge foods and our binge behaviors. If tempted, we recoil from it as from a hot flame. We react sanely and normally. We will find that this has happened automatically. We will see that our new attitude toward liquor, towards our binge foods, our binge behaviors, has been given us without any thought or effort on our part. It just comes. That's the miracle of it. We're not fighting it, neither are we avoiding temptation. We feel as though we have been placed in a position of neutrality, safe and protected. We have not even sworn off. Instead, the problem has been removed. It doesn't exist for us. We are neither cocky nor are we afraid. That is our experience. Those promises, I mean, I've been to too many OA meetings where I haven't heard these kinds of promises. And when I've spoken to people after the meeting and said, I can be at a restaurant and my wife can order a very delicious dessert and say, oh, this is the best dessert I've ever had. And I am happy for her. And I am not jealous of her. And I can watch her eat it and not even want to taste it, even though I've never had this taste before. And when she finishes only half of it and says, I'm full, I don't get angry at her. And I don't want to eat what's left. And I say, that's a miracle for me. Is that a miracle for you? People will say, that's a miracle. You know, because that is what we're really looking for. We want relief from our addiction. We don't want to be addicts anymore and always going back to that which we know causes us problems. So I just want to emphasize those promises because I don't think we emphasize them enough. Now, very quickly, I want to talk about steps 10 and 11. And I want to contrast steps 10 and 11 with between each other, because step 10 is a guide for continuing to keep clean for the rest of our lives, whereas step 11 is a guide for living our life on a day-to-day basis, one day at a time. And I think this distinction is important. First of all, I'll deal with step 11 before I go to step 10. You know, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him. You know, that was written and the big book was written before there was a lot of talk about meditation as we now talk about it. You know, the sitting quietly in one place with a candle or, you know, just letting things open up to us. That was being done. But that's not what the big book is about. The big book has very specific suggestions. At the end of the day, we review the day that has passed and we see how we did. And we use the criteria of selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened. Not quite the same words, but approximately the same words. And we see whether during the day we exhibited any of the defects of character. And we figure out what we could have done better. And we resolve that we will do better the next day. So we've reviewed the day. And then in the morning, we get up and we review the day that's to come. And the big book gives us various guides. First of all, prayers that put us in a position of receiving intuition and intuitive thought. Second of all, just planning our day. Third of all, what if we can't plan our day? What if we don't know what's going to happen? We relax, we say certain prayers, and then we relax because if we are close to our higher power, if we're living according to what we distinctly believe in, then we will make the right decision, mostly, generally speaking, because we won't be worrying about the consequences or the reactions. We will only be worrying about whether we are making our decisions for the right reasons. And that has freed me and freed countless other people, because when we think about the day that's to come and we say, we're not looking for our own self-aggrandizement, we're not looking to be loved, we're just looking to do the right thing. And then during the day, we often do get upset. What do? We repeat little mantras. And mantras like, I'm no longer running the show, I'm no longer running the show, I'm no longer running the show, or thy will not mine be done, thy will not mine be done, thy will not mine be done. And I can't tell you how at times when I've been really, really bothered, repeating that phrase, those phrases over and over and over again until suddenly I say, yeah, I'm not running the show anymore. Thy will not mine be done. And suddenly I'm relaxed. And when I'm relaxed, I can think better. I mean, it's as simple as that. But those are day-to-day things. What I want to emphasize in the little time I have left to me is step 10. Because I think this is misunderstood for very understandable reasons. First of all, the way it's written, step 10 is written in the steps, the 12 steps, is continue to take personal inventory. And when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. For 7 years, I went in and out of relapse. And one of the reasons I went in and out of relapse was that I thought that meant that when I yelled at my children, I should apologize to them. When we were wrong, promptly admitted it. I didn't realize until I looked back that what was really going on in my life were some very, very difficult issues relating to family, deaths, illnesses, in which I was in tremendous grief and resentment that things were happening to people I loved, that I couldn't deal with. And what did I do? I couldn't yell at them. I yelled at my kids. Easy to yell at them. And apologizing to them did not do what steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 had done for me in terms of what had been going on in my life and how I isolated my self-will, my dishonesty, my defects, and my self-seeking and my fears, and learned to live with my fears. What kind of person should I be? And when I finally heard a speaker speak about step 10 as it's written in the big book, that speaker pointed out that what it says is to do steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9 as a recovered person. Every so often, we have to do steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, because by the time we finish step 9, when we're promised these promises of recovery, this promise of neutrality in relation to food, the spiritual life, we're promised these things. Between the time we finished our step 9 and today, there's a past that has grown up. And the past may be 1 minute long, or it may be 1 year long. Who knows how long it's been? Things have happened. Things go on in this world. I mean, we're living in a difficult world. It's difficult things are happening that cause us all kinds of concerns, and sometimes we don't even know it. Sometimes we begin to realize only late in the day that we've been living in what the equivalent of is a noisy factory, where you get used to the noise and you don't realize what an impact it's had on your way of thinking, your ability to think, and your ability to live. And so, thank you. And so what was really important was to understand that step 10 is in fact all of steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, done the way we did steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. How often do we do it? Well, some people say we do it every day. I say that's step 11. And I say that step 11 is done on a day-to-day basis. We review just the day. And it's not overall, and I'll give you an example in a moment. I say I do it whenever I'm restless, irritable, or discontented. I do it when I'm feeling useless, when the meetings become boring, when I'm just subject to fits of rage, or when the food begins to tempt me, which has rarely happened, but it has happened at times. It's time to do a step 10. It's time to figure out what the heck is going on in my entire life. And I have written things down that I didn't even know would be there until I started to write them down. It's a written inventory. It's the same as step 4. And then I give it away in step 5. And then I say the step 7 prayer, because obviously I want my defects of character to be removed. And then I figure out what amends have to be made. Now, the amends are almost always these days living amends. I know enough now. I've been doing this a long time to apologize if I've done anything in particular, or to make up for any specific wrongs I've done. But it's really adjusting my reactions to life that I need to do this inventory process for. So step 10 is a way of dealing with everything that's going on in my life. And goodness knows a lot is going on in all of our lives, not just our individual lives, but the world. It's a very changing, difficult world for many of us to live in. And we don't even notice it. We become used to it. So step 10, the example I give you is that in the last 3 or 4 years of her life, my mother suffered a great deal and was very unhappy and had a lot of difficulty speaking and mobility issues. Every night I would do a step 11 meditation. Had I done the right thing for her and my father? Had I shown them love? Had I given respite? Have I visited them? Did I speak to them? But every week or so, I would write down in the resentment column my mother, my father, my children, my wife, whatever else was going on in my life, and figure out what was bothering me in general. I would discover things that would bother me. You know, I was worried about the relationship my mother and father were having, because my father was now taking care of my mother in essential ways that my mother used to take care of my father in doing. My mother hated being taken care of. My father, I didn't think was used to taking care of someone else, because he had always been taken care of, you know, food and, you know, and bathing and things like that in terms of my mother. I worried about their relationship. I worried about whether, and this was embarrassing to realize, I worried about whether if my father was exerting too much, whether he would die before my mother would. I didn't want that to happen either. And I then worried whether I'd have to bathe my mother, which I didn't want to do. You know, these things came out. They wouldn't have come out on a step 11 evening meditation, but they did come out when I did my step 10. Whenever I've had to make major decisions, career decisions, decisions as to purchases of major issues or things of that sort, anything really difficult, that's been a resentment I've put down and I've done a step 10 of them. And I've done, and I do my step 5. I figure out where I've been, you know, I talk to another human being, and the amends I make are to make the decision based on my deepest values, what I deeply believe in, rather than what other people will think, or rather than what I want or what I desire. So step 10 has been a real lifesaver for me. Without step 10, I would have relapsed years and years ago. It is now 50. So that's, and the big book is always urging us to action. I just want to end up by saying, you know, the big book says on page, it gives us promises of step 11 that we can rely on our hunches and inspirations. And the reason is that steps 4 through 9 have removed the barrier in the pipeline between what we deeply believe in, which is deep in our hearts, and our mind, which is where we think and react and act. And once that barrier is removed, we begin to live according to how we believe, what we deeply believe in, our God, our higher power. The job of steps 10 and 11 is to keep that barrier gone, is to keep the pipeline open. And the big book promises, since that pipeline is now open, our thinking will be clearer. We will be thinking, we will make decisions based on the right motives. And I'll just end with page 88, because if only this were all we needed, if only this was all that we had to do. But the big book now says, but this is not all. There is action and more action. Faith without works is dead. The next chapter is entirely devoted to step 12. And I end this saying, you have given me an opportunity to practice step 12, which I need to practice. And I want to thank you for that opportunity. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Lori, for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today. We will now be transitioning into a question and answer segment. I'd like to introduce Kevin, who will be our moderator for today.
Thank you, Rhonda. Hi, my name is Kevin. I'm a compulsive overeater and your moderator for today. At the beginning of your talk, you mentioned going through the steps rather quickly. The first question is, do you set a particular schedule when you're working with a sponsee, or, you know, maybe speak a little more about your process of going through the steps with a sponsee?
Yes, I believe that every sponsee is different, and I believe every sponsor is different, and that there is no one way to sponsor and no set amount of time that you have to do. You know, I know people who feel so oppressed by, you know, they've come out of relapse, they're even more desperate to work the steps, and their sponsor says to them, well, you've got to read a paragraph at a time every day. Let's read one paragraph of the doctor's opinion. And, you know, I've spoken to them about it. They say, I know the doctor's opinion. I've memorized it. My relapses show me even more how much I have, how desperate I am. So for some people, they go through the steps very quickly. And some people, despite what I the advice I give them, they don't go through as quickly as they should. And they do relapse. I think it depends on how well they read, how well they understand. I think they have to understand the instructions in the big book if they want to be sponsored the big book way. But I don't know how much they have to read because the instructions are pretty clear. And sometimes people sometimes have trouble reading. They really have trouble reading the language in the big book at times. And sometimes it's my job to explain it to them. I go at their pace, always urging them to go as quickly as they can. And so I don't have a set answer to your question. Some people are faster than others. Some people have to be persuaded. I don't persuade them. Some people have to accept how desperate they are. They have to understand that it's a life or death issue. We have one of the least dramatic addictions that you can think of. You know, most of us, the vast majority of them are not going to eat one extra donut or not eat one extra donut and die or gamble away our life savings or walk into a traffic without knowing where we are. So that there's no drama to it. We gradually deteriorate. we lose parts of our bodies. We lose some of our senses. We become less mobile. We rely on other people. We isolate more. It's not dramatic, but it is life or death, and one of the leading causes, preventable causes of death in the world. So sometimes people have to recognize how important this addiction is and how life or death it is. So I don't have any set answer to that question. It's really as fast as people want to go.
Could you speak a little more about resentment in light of the four character defects you mentioned? How would you sort of like define resentment using those characteristics?
Thank you. I would say that a resentment is not simply something we're angry about. That's how the big book sometimes talks about it, although you can argue that in other parts of the big book, it talks about resentment the way I'm about to speak it. A resentment is simply life isn't going my way or life hasn't gone my way. The Latin origin is re sentire. Re means again. Sentire is to feel. So anything that's living rent-free in our mind, anything that we think about all the time is a resentment. And a resentment can be as specific as a person or institutions, which are collections of people whom we don't know or whose names we don't know. And it can also be a principle. And a principle can be a fact which we wish were not true because it's something that bothers us. So a principle can be, I'll never get thin, no one will ever love me, I'll always be lonely. But a principle can also be, people are dying all over the world and I'm having a good time. Or there is evil in this world. Or bad things are happening to people. So it can be very broad. A resentment can be as deep and traumatic as the person who traumatized me, not me, but friends of mine, or as trivial but still resentful as people who park over the yellow lines in large parking lots and make you walk an extra three parking spots. If they're irritating, that could be. If they bother you, they bother you. So resentment is very broad, and I really encourage people to interpret a resentment as being really broad, not something that they necessarily have done to others or that others have done to them, but something that just bothers them. Because what they're doing in the first column of step four is writing out all the things that are living rent-free in their minds. And it's amazing to pour that out on paper. When you get to the fourth column, which is where you've been self-willed, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened, you're then identifying, it's almost generic in the sense that it is life hasn't gone my way. I want life to be different. That's self-will. I mean, sometimes we'll find that it's also selfish in the dictionary definition. It's been my fault. I've done something that has caused this, or I've allowed it to live rent-free in my mind for a long time. The dishonesty can sometimes be lying. The dishonesty can sometimes be being silent. That is a dishonesty. And we are, so many of us as people pleasers are silent when we should not be. Some of us are dishonest by not speaking the truth in a way that other people can hear. You know, it's very different to say to someone, you're a racist, and say to someone, what you said has deeply hurt me and makes me concerned about your attitude towards life. Big, big difference. So sometimes the dishonesty is a subtle kind of dishonesty. Self-seeking is almost always about who you are, seeking yourself through other people. And it's either a self-aggrandizement, oh, if I were in charge, life would be better, or I'm worth nothing because other people don't like me or have treated me badly. And then fear is just the future won't go my way.
Can you, Laura, can you speak a little bit more about shaming and guilt in steps 8 and 9? And just to put the question in some context, the person who asked the question, you know, said that they often, you know, think they owe people amends for, you know, being in their lives. And, you know, a secondary question to that is, you know, how does one release themselves from self-loathing and shame without doing, you know, harm to other people?
You know, I mean, this is such a common occurrence that I've experienced in step fives with other people. I also have had on a personal level, one of the jobs I had in the last years of my work life was interviewing people who were victims of sexual and physical abuse. And I must have spoken to, well, I did speak to 300 to 500 people and interviewed them. What amazed is not the right word, saddened me. Really overpowered me in many ways, was that people felt guilt about what an adult did to them when they were 5 years old or 6 years old, shame and guilt for what was done to them by someone who was in charge of them or had power over them when they had absolutely no power, and they felt shame and guilt for that. And when that comes out, that's self-seeking in gone to such an extreme, but it's so common. I've experienced it. And the amends that you make for that is really realizing that the only way you get true understanding of who you are as a human being is by your relationship with what you deeply believe in. That's the only way you'll get out of that, that you are not responsible for what others have done to you, and that you are not defined by what others have done for you. You're defined by how well you live according to what you believe in. And sometimes that's the only amends that we owe to the world, living as human beings who feel comfortable with living according to what they believe in. I don't know whether that helps or not. I only know that in the experience of step five, it has helped a lot of people. Okay, so in the moment, in discussing it, in sharing it, that when you begin to think about, well, what kind of a person can I be in relation to the fears I've developed, in relation to the shame and guilt I feel for what was done to me, the person I can be is a person who lives according to what I deeply believe in. Whether it's a specific God or the deep values that I have, it doesn't matter. If you live according to what you believe in, those are the people we respect in life. You know, even the people who don't believe in the same things we do, if they live and don't according to what they believe in and don't care what other people think of them, but care about whether they're deeply living according to what is important to them, we respect that. And that's how we get our sense of self-esteem. I don't know if that answers it well enough. I can only say that the steps give us that. You know, it's not that I can't speak and say, you know, suddenly you will be relieved of your shame and guilt. I can say that if you do the analysis of step four, if you share it in step five, if you figure out what harm you've done in steps, you know, if you say the step seven prayer, because you'll be ready in step six to give it up, you know, and if you figure out and do the analysis, what harm have I done? You will, I think it's fair to say, if you do it as honestly as you can, you will find the recovery that is guaranteed in the big book. So,
thank you. I have another question. It's a follow-up from the previous question on resentment. Do you have any guidance on how to approach doing a fourth or fifth step around a resentment on a global issue, perhaps like state of the world kind of an issue?
Yep. You know,
God knows there are many to choose from.
Yep.
Rather than a personal one.
Well, I'll tell you mine. And it's very sad that some issues have become political where they ought not to be. They ought to be scientific. But at any rate, I was, without going into any detail, I was going through a time, and this was only a few years ago, where I was looking at my grandchildren and just weeping about the future that we're leaving them, and that they'll be living and that I won't be living it. And I did a step 10 on that. 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I wrote down, these are the things that worry me about the future that they're going to be encountering. And I think it's fair to say that regardless of the politics of anyone, most of us think that the future is not going to be a happy one, for most of the world. So I did my step 4 and 5 on it. And I began to realize that the dishonesty was that there were some things I could do and there were some things I had no choice over, I had no power over, and that I was denying my grandchildren the things I could give them by being so paralyzed by the fears and the sadnesses I was feeling. What could I give them? I could transfer to them as much as possible love of humanity. I could show them love. I could show them a skeptical, intelligent mind that might be curious and creative. I could talk to them about resilience, about handling difficult issues. I can't govern what's going to happen to them in their life. And so for world situations, knowing the difference between what I can change and what I can't change, the Serenity Prayer, and having the courage to know what I can do, at least gives me a strategy in life. I can't change the future of this world. I mean, goodness knows I can't. And because of that, that doesn't mean I should be paralyzed. I should still live as useful a life as I can. Now, I sponsor people with political views completely different from mine. It doesn't matter to me what they believe. What matters to me is whether they approach it with the love and compassion, tolerance, pity, and patience that the Big Book speaks about. No one should hate in this program. We cannot afford to hate. We cannot afford to be angry, because that will send us back to our addiction. We have to address people as with tolerance, pity, and patience, and honesty. And that's what's important. And I think I don't think there's any difference between world events and events in our own lives. There are some things we can't change and we have to accept, and there's some things we can change and we have to do them.
Thank you. I have about two questions. I think they're related, but you can decide if they are related and how to answer them. What is your thoughts on the idea, you know, should one get abstinent and then work the steps, or work the steps and then get abstinent?
No. let me emphasize,
please,
this. I would say that no Big Book reader would in any way, shape, or form read the Big Book to say that you get abstinent after you work the steps. I would say that it's taken for granted that you get sober, because only if you are abstinent from what causes you your addiction are you able to think clearly and honestly enough about steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. There's a disagreement among many of us as to whether you have to be abstinent step 1 or abstinent step 3. But by the time you start step 4, if you're not abstinent, how can you be rigorously honest? Because the Big Book says you have to be rigorously honest. If you're lying to yourself about your food, then then you aren't capable of being rigorously honest. I have a friend who was a member of AA, NA, and OA. He was sober and clean in NA and in AA and NA for years. He was a Big Book fanatic. He knew more than I did about the Big Book. He asked me to sponsor him. I said, fine. I don't think you need a sponsor, but I'm honored. I said, let's get you abstinent. I said, I can't get abstinent. I'm hoping that, you know, by working the steps, I'll get abstinent. I said, if someone came to you in AA and said, would you sponsor me? I'm hoping that as I work, I'll continue to drink. But, you know, I'm hoping that if I work the steps with you, I'll get sober. What would you say to them, to that person, to those people? I won't use the exact words he used, but they were equivalent to go away. And I would say, well, what do you want me to say to you? He said, well, please help me. So I said, fine, I don't know what good it'll do, but I'll do whatever I can. He did step four, he did step five. He said he'd never done a better step five. He even made amends. 3 years later, he died by suicide, never got abstinent. And I take that, I'm telling you, I've lived with that feeling that I miss him. He's a great man, but he never got abstinent. And so there may be people who will say, I got abstinent after I worked the steps. But I want to suggest, A, that that isn't the way the big book is written, or most 12-step fellowships take for granted that you're clean. And B, that what happened to them was that at the moment they got abstinent, they had the spiritual awakening that was promised by steps 4 through 9. They may not have done it in quite the same order, but it was for them a sudden spiritual experience. And the amends that they were making by being abstinent was what was something that happened really at the step one level for them. They became so desperate that they finally got honest with themselves. I don't know, but yes, I'm pretty clear. Doesn't mean I haven't sponsored people who have tried to do it, you know? And at a certain point they've said, this time I got to get abstinent. Well, they've already done steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. They haven't been abstinent. They get abstinent. There's not much left to do, but it's in the act of getting abstinent that they truly surrender and that they're able to understand what more they have to do to make amends. And it's almost always at that point, living amends that they haven't done. Because if you're not abstinent, what kind of a living amend are you making to all the people who love you and are watching you suffer? You're making no amends whatsoever if you're continuing to eat or continuing to binge or do whatever you shouldn't be doing, you should be abstaining from.
Thank you. I'll ask you the second part of the question in a second. It is now 15 minutes to the hour, and our Q&A time is almost over. We have 5 more minutes. And the second part of the question, I would say is, you know, you shared that you had recovered from relapse. Can you share a little bit about how did you, you know, that moment when you said, okay, I surrender?
All right. My recovery from relapse occurred in two ways. I just want to say, by the way, I have my email address. If there are unanswered questions that people want to ask me about, my email address is shown there for people on the phone. It's chernsatmts.net. So I'm happy to answer any questions by email. I was in relapse for on and off for 7 years. I was finally confronted by the shyest person in the room, who said to me, how are you, Laurie? And I said, fine. And, you know, many people had asked me that. And their answer was always, oh, good to see you. You know, keep on talking, keep on coming back. What she said to me was, she looked me in the eye about two inches away from my eyes. And she said, I mean, really? And I, whoa, God. And she told me that she had prayed for 3 weeks before she did that, you know. And she really started to get me on a road towards recovery. But my real relapse, I didn't get out of my relapse until I was asked to sponsor a person who had been sober for 15 years in AA, who had been a student of the Big Book, and who got me accepting that what I was doing wasn't working. And that when the doctor's opinion talked about allergy of the body, it meant simply an abnormal reaction to a substance, as opposed to hives or diarrhea or anything like that. Once I accepted that, and once I accepted that the notion of the allergy was cravings, that was the symptoms, uncontrollable cravings, I then understood that it wasn't a matter, as my sponsor told me, of dieting and then eating moderately and working the steps and eating whatever I wanted, as all the diets had told me I could do, but actually abstaining from some things that caused me uncontrollable cravings. And I had to do the analysis because it's different for each one of us. We all have different things that cause us cravings. Some of us have behaviors like bulimia or anorexia, some of it or chewing, and some of us have other specific substances. I have combinations of ingredients. So it requires that analysis. Once I did that, and then once I understood that step 10 required me to continue to do inventories, I was home free.
Thank you, Lori. And I think we have time for just another question. And could you share a little bit about your daily spiritual practice?
It's the worst part of my program. I will admit that carefully. I am no idol or poster child for OA. I mean, I'm abstinent, and I keep abstinent, and I have the promises. I begin my day with thinking about what my day is going to be like. I end the day with thinking what my day was like. I'm retired now, so my days aren't very different. And I don't do a lot. I do a lot of step 12s. I do step 10s whenever I need to. And my step 11s, my daily practice, I share. I'm on Zoom or Skype or whatever a lot with a lot of people. I sponsor a lot of people. I go to meetings. That's about it. I should do more step 11s. I would say that. She asked me an embarrassing question. And that's the end of it, eh? I'm asking an embarrassing question, and that's the last thing I've talked about. Okay, that's good.
You're in very good company, Lori, and thank you so much for your service. It's now 10 minutes to the hour, and our Q&A time has come to an end. There were other questions that did not get answered, but I encourage you to stay on or to take Lori up on his offer and send him an email.
I will stay on, Kevin. I was asked to stay on after the recording, and I'll be happy to do that.
Great. Thank you. And now I'll hand the meeting back to our chairperson, Rhonda.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you, Lori. We are now come to the part for seventh tradition. According to our seventh tradition, we are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. As we have now moved to virtual meetings, it is important that we continue to be fully self-supporting. This allows Overeaters Anonymous to continue to carry the message to those that still suffer. You're able to send your contribution through our website at www.ad4l.info. For those of you able to see the Zoom chat, the link will also be posted there. Thank you all for your support. It is appreciated. Just a reminder that A Design for Living, Big Book, OA, is a daily meeting. We are based out of Melbourne, Australia. The recording from today's workshop will be available from our website, where you can also find out about other upcoming events and speakers. Please visit our website at ad4l.info. Our next monthly speaker series will be held on Sunday, August 13th, 7:30 to 9 a.m. The topic will be Working with Others. We hope to see you there. In closing, I would like to say thank you to all for your service in coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. We find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways that OA can help you. Please remember, the opinions expressed here today are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together, we get better. To close the meeting, will Mickey please unmute and read the promises?
I'm Mickey, compulsive overeater. The promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We're going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past, nor wish to shut the door on it. We will comprehend the word serenity, and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.